Last week, I presented a critique of the first part of the Seder, which was that freedom is not about appetizers and getting to wash a couple of times and lying down when you eat on pillows. Actually just gives you indigestion. And all of the trappings pointing to getting to have salt water on the table. Ooh, things like getting served lots of wine. I know that comes close. But none of those qualify as freedom. And all the first part of the Seder is a mockery, because freedom are not the material trappings of wealth. They are actually, freedom is what you do with your freedom. So that was my thesis last week. Freedom is what you do with your freedom, not somehow being free, like we run off into a field. So then what is freedom in the Seder? It starts with magid. It starts with storytelling. Magid is the telling of our story, and which were the same word as Haggadah. It's, as the Talmud says, the first part is just to trick a child into asking you, why are you doing this? What is this? Manishtana. What's going on? And the rest, the thing about the dipping and the lying down, it's just, it's really just a kind of joke. It's just a way to prod a child into getting you to ask you that. And even the four questions, the four children, so then you can say, good, we got the question, and now I get to tell you the story. Magid. I get to give you Haggadah, which is not reading with an outstretched arm. Rabbi Akiva said, an outstretched arm. It's the story of our people. It's the story of saying, look, where you come from a people, and we have a story, and you get to tell that story in your own words. And that's the purpose of the Haggadah, that's the purpose of the Seder, and that is what gets to unlock what is the meaning of freedom. Reb Shlomo Carlebach said that he became a Jew, his father made him a Jew at the Seder. It was at the Seder where he learned what it meant to be a Jew, and he got made a Jew through this process. Share with you an essay. I'm probably not the only one who came across it. I know Rabbi Shabbatai came across it and sent it to me as well. From one of the few sane pundits in this country, in my opinion, David Brooks. He's Jewish, he's a Republican. I hope people don't hold either of those against him. And he wrote this recently, and I'm going to share parts of it with you. One of the things that we've lost in our country is our story. Remember, Magid is the storytelling. It's what tells you at the Seder, what makes you a Jew, what makes you understand what freedom is. And David Brooks says, I don't think coincidentally, I think he knows Pesach is coming up, that it's the story of your country, of your people, that makes you an American. It's the narrative that unites us around a common multi-generational project. Again, the Seder, multi-generational, right? The children asking the question, the adults giving the answers so that they can take over. And it gives an overarching sense of meaning and purpose to our history. For most of the past 400 years, Americans did have an overarching story. It was the Exodus story. The Puritans came to this continent and felt they were escaping the bondage of their Egypt and building a new Jerusalem, and they talked about it explicitly in those terms over and over again. The Exodus story has six acts. First, a life of slavery and oppression. Then, the revolt against tyranny. Again, think the Haggadah. We don't read the story from the Bible. We tell it, and we tell it just like this. Oppression, then revolt against tyranny, then the difficult flight through the howling wilderness, then the infighting and misbehavior amid the stress of that ordeal, then the handing down of a new covenant, a new law, and then finally the arrival in the Promised Land and the project of building a new Jerusalem. The Puritans could survive hardship because they knew what kind of cosmic drama they were involved in. Being a chosen people with a sacred mission didn't make them arrogant. It gave their task dignity and consequence. It made them self-critical. When John Winthrop used the phrase shining city on a hill, he didn't say it as self-congratulation. He actually used it to chastise what was going on. He said that the whole world was watching, and by the selfishness of what was going on, the colonists were failing to live up to their story. As Philip Gorski writes in his new book, American Covenant, the Puritans understood that they were part of a covenant, and they had ongoing ferocious debates about what that covenant meant. Later, during the American Revolution, the Founding Fathers had that fierce urgency too, and drew just as heavily upon the Exodus story. I insert here that we today overquote that thing about freedom is the pursuit of happiness. We all love that. But that's actually mostly not what the Founding Fathers talked about. They talked about the Exodus story. Some of our Founding Fathers wanted to depict Moses on the Great Seal of the United States. And because Moses, America too was rebuilding itself with a new covenant and a new law. Frederick Douglass, he embraced the Exodus too. African Americans, he pointed out, have been part of this journey. He said, "We came when it was wilderness, and we were the ones who leveled your forests, and it was our hands that removed the stumps from the field. And we have been with you in adversity, and by the help of God, we will be with you in prosperity." Successive immigrant groups saw themselves performing an exodus to the Promised Land. We all know that. The waves of mobility from the east part of the United States to the west, from the south to the north, were also seen as exodus journeys. People could endure the hardship because they knew they were serving in a spiritual drama, not just a financial one. In the 20th century, of course, Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders constantly drew on the Exodus story. Our 20th century presidents made the story global. America was part of a story of bringing democracy to the world against the Soviet Union. God was a God of all peoples. Reinhold Niebuhr applied Puritan thinking to America's mission, and he warned of the taint of national pride. The Exodus story has many virtues as a national myth. It welcomes in each new group and gives it a template for how it can fit into our story and our move from oppression to dignity and where America is going. The book of Exodus is full of social justice, care for the vulnerable, the equality of all souls. It emphasizes that the moral and the material journeys are intertwined, and that for a nation to succeed materially, there has to be an invisible moral constitution and a fervent effort toward character education. It suggests that history can move upward. It lives in the Exodus story. Even as Langston Hughes famously put it, "America never was America to me, but I'd swear this oath, it will be." But the Exodus narrative, it's pretty much been dropped from contemporary discourse in our civic culture. Schools cast off the Puritans as a bunch of religious fundamentalists. People on the left have made history and history teaching look like just a series of power conflicts between oppressor and oppressed. The left has turned history into a series of power conflicts between oppressor and oppressed. So therefore, the implication to our young people is it's just about winners and losers. It's not about a story of where this is going. Too many people on the right have become jingoistic chauvinists who measure Americanness not by the mission of where we're going morally and spiritually, but by blood. And they want to create a fortress America, keeping the enemy out. We have a lot of crises in our country, but maybe the foundational one is the telos crisis, the crisis of purpose. Many people don't know what this country is here for and what we are here for. If you don't know what your goal is, then every setback sends you into cynicism and selfishness, and it's us against them. If only we could revive the Exodus template and to see Americans as a single people trekking through a landscape, perhaps now of broken institutions. And what's needed is an act of imagination, somebody who can tell us what our goal is and offer a vision of what this country and the world should be. It's the end of David Brooks's essay. And we go back to the Haggadah. So it's not about, well, now we're the winners, and the Romans are the losers, or we're usually the men. We're the winners, and the Egyptians are the losers, and now we get to recline on pillows, and we get to have salt water and appetizers. That's the material dimension of it, and the Haggadah is undermining it. It's about the spiritual dimension of, now I tell you the story. And the story tells you, you want to be on board with the story? You know where we're going? It says we came from oppression to freedom. My daughter Marav's favorite movie is Moana. So if you know I hate Disney, but it's a great movie. So Moana is fabulous. And it is about a girl who learns the stories of her ancestors from her grandmother and wants to take her place in the story. And again, Marav asked me, Daddy, because the ancestors visit sometimes in stories and sometimes as ghosts. And she keeps asking me, well, who are ancestors? My ancestors. I want to know who my ancestors were. And so I've been telling her, like the Haggadah, not by quoting a book and not by getting out the Torah. I tell her, this is our story. There was this couple called Abraham and Sarah. And they left the village they came from because they wanted to create a new kind of tribe. A new kind of, and she gets the word tribe, it's in Moana, it's in everything. They wanted to create a new tribe. A tribe where things could be different. A tribe where women had rights, men had rights, where people who visited were safe, and it was like people could learn, and there was no bullying allowed. And they realized this was going to be really, really hard. And Abraham went to, and they went to dangerous places, and they lived through lots of hardships until Abraham started to make a little money as a shepherd. And when he got money, you know what he did? He didn't buy a lot of gold and stuff. He employed people. He had more and more animals, and he said his dignity, his great kavod, came from how many people he could employ. And they lived in the land, and they lived in tents, and they went from place to place, and they welcomed them. Every stranger that passed by, they gave asylum to, and they gave food to, and they treated as a friend. And then he gave birth, and our next ancestors were their kids, Isaac and Rebecca. And Rebecca was this woman who could understand what people needed and animals needed, and she didn't need to be told in words. And she helped free Isaac's soul, because Isaac was a really quiet boy, but really, really sweet and noble. And she had a way of freeing that soul, and they fell deeply in love. And she became a great leader of our tribe with Isaac by her side. And she continued that story. And then they had Jacob and Rachel and Leah. And Jacob, he was not considered to take over the tribe, and he was ignored. But he was a great leader, and his mommy helped him. And he made his way in the world, and he built up. He took over with the tribe, and he was a really scared guy, and he got over his fears in order to be a leader. And he had two wives, and one he deeply loved and died young and was compassionate, and the other one was someone, she wasn't real, real pretty, but he still loved her in his way, and she had many children, and she built up the tribe from her children. And then we ended up enslaved in Egypt. And we couldn't even be free. And all this project that we were going to make a society in which people's dignity was preserved and even animals had rights. And so you couldn't even hurt an animal. And that you couldn't hurt the poor. And you couldn't even take their money if they owed you money if they were too poor. And now we get to the book of Leviticus today. And as soon as we got, God freed us from there, then God said, okay, now make that society. Make Vayikra, make a temple, and now you're going to have to give up a lot of the stuff you own. You've got to give up some of your money, and you've got to give up some of your fruit, because it's only together that you're going to be able to make this society come true according to these laws, protecting people's dignities, bringing education for everybody, men and women, intellectual curiosity. We have a rule that says whatever your personal relationship with God is, that's up to you, and we're not going to get between you and God and get involved in that, but we do ask you to be a nice person. And we do ask you to join in the story, because we're going to take this love of education and a passion for monotheism, the fact that we, and Marav says, what is that? It's that everything we live in is part of one thing, and it's all interconnected. And the more you, Marav, understand it, the better you get at math, and the better you get at science, and the more cures we find for diseases, and the better things we can come up with, we do it because we want to make it a better place. When we understand our system, we can bring it into harmony, and we can create that society. And those are your ancestors. And this is our story. And when you've been enslaved like we were, and it looked like we wouldn't even get a chance to do it, you know that you can't waste a minute of your life. You got to be a part of it. And you want to be a part of it. It's not where you just get with, I get the pursuit of happiness, and I get to lie down on a pillow. But when you know your story, then you want to be a part of it. And when someone else says, can I be a part of your story? They're not just saying, hey, I like your ancestors. They're saying, I want to be part of the story because I want to be part of where it's going.